The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from the offices of Squire Patton Boggs, this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here is your host.
All right, good afternoon. This is Kevin O'Neill. Thanks for joining us on Capital Thinking. We've got a great show for you today. U.S. patent reform, the Strong Patents Act. We're going to talk a little bit about global derivatives and futures, and then round up with a tax and municipal bond reform report. It is our version of March Madness as we wallow in some wonkiness here. So thanks for joining us. We're going to start with Greg Lauer, a star associate and colleague of mine at the Squire Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office. We're going to talk a little bit about U.S. patent reform. Greg, welcome back, and tell us a little bit about where you think patent litigation reform stands in this 114th Congress as we finish the first quarter of their two-year term.
Certainly, and thank you, Kevin, for hosting me once again. It's always a pleasure to be with you. I think this is one of the most interesting issues that is developing in this Congress, and certainly one of the few issues that stands a real chance of becoming something that the president can ultimately sign into law this year. As you know, there are very few issues in Congress in an era of divided government where both Republicans and Democrats found common ground on an issue that impacts stakeholders of almost every stripe in this country. So patent reform, to me, stands a very good chance of ultimately becoming law, although there are some significant hurdles that will evolve over time.
Interesting. Okay. So I know what makes there's been some changes. Obviously, we flipped control of the Senate from Democrats to Republicans in from the last Congress to this Congress. Republicans actually picked up seats in the House, have a historic high number of seats there. Besides the composition of the partisan shift there, what else has changed about the environment and the ability to cooperate that makes you think we'll get somewhere?
Well, I think, first of all, there's great momentum from the last Congress, particularly in the House, with an incredible bipartisan majority that favored the Innovation Act in the last Congress. You had that bill pass on a vote of 325-91, which for an issue as important as patent reform is really kind of unbelievable if you think about it. There are very few bills that pass with that kind of bipartisan majority in the 113th Congress that had that degree of bipartisan support for an issue that was not fluff. Of course, patent litigation reform is anything but. It's very, very sensitive. It's very, very complicated. So that shows you that there is a great deal of bipartisan support for this bill. On the Senate side, the composition of the Congress and definitely changes the dynamic. Of course, last year, the patent reform train bogged down a little bit in the Judiciary Committee when the committee leaders were not able to find a bipartisan consensus to get that bill or a similar version of the Innovation Act out. It was a very different product than what the House put forward. But ultimately, there was no consensus that could move the bill out of the Judiciary Committee and onto the floor in a way that would be acceptable and ultimately receive 60 votes or more. I think that process is going to be a little different this year. With the dynamic and who's controlling the gavel, quite different. I think certain stakeholders have a little less influence over the process than maybe they did last year. But ultimately, the same first principles apply. The Judiciary Committee isn't going to send anything to the floor that doesn't have a very good chance of getting 60 votes. But I think that there is a very good chance that that will ultimately happen, as opposed to last year, where the political dynamics in an election year made it very difficult.
Interesting. Well, so let's get into a little more of the politics and talk about ways that this could all go wrong. Talk to me about the fault lines that could derail patent reform this year.
Well, I think that one of the first issues that needs to be cleared is the impact of a couple of Supreme Court cases that impacted the landscape last year. And I speak, of course, of Alice and Octane Fitness, which respectively carried incredible impact for the patent bar. And both of those impact, you know, the quality of patents and what the patent office is able to do in the litigation context. And Octane Fitness, that impacted the fee-shifting dynamic to a considerable extent, and that the Supreme Court effectively lowered the bar for recovery for those that are trying to recover fees under the Patent Act. So you have two cases that definitely changed the game, and that has definitely formed part of the narrative at the beginning of this Congress. At least one committee in Congress, the House Judiciary Committee, has already explored that issue in a hearing, and I think that it's already come up in the Senate as well, in the Judiciary Committee, although that was not the foundation of the hearing that just took place last week. Another interesting issue is I think the Supreme Court decisions are just going to continue to permeate the debate, because ultimately the law has evolved around those cases, and Congress is going to have to keep up. Another dynamic that is going to be moving forward is how the JCUS plans for moving forward to pleading reform, how those evolve, and how Congress can ultimately keep up with those. Unless something changes, there's a fairly robust proposal from the JCUS to ultimately shift the pleading standard more towards the traditional Rule 8 under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure standard. And that's definitely going to be a game changer in the patent litigation arena as well. And it will make proving up a case much more difficult for those that are trying to prove a violation.
All right, so let's go back to these Supreme Court cases, Alice and Octane Fitness. I don't know much about them, and I'm trying to get a better sense of how they reinforce or undermine an argument by patent reform advocates that there's an urgent need for reform.
Well, I want to start probably with the latter in Octane Fitness and then an accompanying case, Highmark. In those instances, the Supreme Court interpreted the quote-unquote what is an exceptional case under the Patent Act, and the Patent Act has a unique provision that is statutorily determines how one can recover attorney's fees, and it's always been a very exceptionally difficult, pardon the pun, standard to overcome for parties that prevail. And in Octane Fitness and Highmark, the court effectively lowered that standard. In those cases, the court ruled that an exceptional case is one that stands out from others with respect to the substantive strength of a party's litigation. And the court also lowered the standard of proof in fee-shifting claims to preponderance of the evidence. That is a big deal. Also, judges will now be able to evaluate the exceptionality via totality of the circumstances. So these are in the litigation arena for those that practice in the patent bar, huge developments that should make it easier, and I believe already are making it easier for parties to recover.
Okay. So let's go back, and we talked a little bit about the fault lines. Talk to me about the personalities. Let's start in the House, then we'll go to the Senate. But who are the key players on patent reform amongst those members of Congress?
Well, certainly Chairman Goodlatte from the House Judiciary Committee, the full committee chairman, is the driving force behind this effort. His name is attached to H.R. 9, the Innovation Act, as it was last year. And he will be the person to bring the legislation to the floor and ultimately carry it across the goal line. Ultimately, he will be aided in that effort by former House Oversight Committee Chairman Daryl Issa, who is now the Intellectual Property Subcommittee Chairman. He has already conducted one or two hearings, I believe, on patent reform, including the hearing that dealt specifically with the impact of Supreme Court case law. So those two individuals will continue to be very important. Of course, on the ranking member side, you have ranking member Conyers from Michigan, who one might say begrudgingly supported the Innovation Act last year because of the aggressive provisions in that legislation regarding fee shifting. On the Senate side, you have Chairman Grassley on the Senate Judiciary Committee, who will have a very important role to play. On the flip side of that, you will have Mr. Cornyn as well from Texas, who's the number two Republican in the leadership chain in the Senate, who's going to play a very, very key player, has introduced his own legislation in the past on this issue that has driven the debate to a degree. And then on the Senate Democratic side, one of the key players that you're going to have to watch who doesn't actually have a leadership role within the Judiciary Committee is Senator Schumer. Senator Schumer has his own ideas for patent reform that are a little bit different than the rest of the community and the Democratic side. He can play ball with Republicans on this issue and has really expressed a willingness and a desire to strike a deal. You hear his name linked quite often with Senator Cornyn in terms of whom is really driving this process in the Senate. So I would pay attention to those trio of senators first and foremost.
Okay, so then I want to talk about who are the outside players. Who are the biggest interest groups or corporations, associations that are driving this fight on either side?
Well, if you make something in this country, or even if you use something that's made in this country, and it's really that wide of a universe of stakeholders. You have universities, you have pharmaceutical interests, you have major manufacturers, software developers, engineers, entrepreneurs that buy and sell patent portfolios, and those that are in the middle of this space. The patent litigation fight, so to speak, touches upon almost every area of the economy. It's incredibly diverse.
Yes, it is. So, all right, so last question, Greg. Sort of spin forward for me what you think the timeline is for action in both chambers, you know, best and worst case scenario.
Well, I think the House will ultimately move fairly quickly on H.R. 9. H.R. 9 is the mirror image of legislation that was passed in the last Congress. There could be some tweaks to the bill as it moves through the process, although I don't expect any of those to be material. Chairman Issa has been very explicit in his discussion around that issue. He will not accept anything that does not bring additional votes to the floor. So something would really have to dramatically change the game in order for the bill to change in a material way on the House side. The real interest is coming on the Senate side, and I'll back up and say I would be shocked if this bill does not move out of the House in the before the summer. I think the process is probably going to be a little bit longer in the Senate because folks are just a little bit more deliberate in how they negotiate these issues, and I think there's quite a bit of wait and see going on right now to see how the Innovation Act plays out.
Very good. All right, Greg Lauer, folks, from Squire Patton Boggs. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about some related topics here on Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Need to keep up to date with regulatory matters? Looking to expand your business globally? We've got enviable connections in D.C., Brussels, and beyond with commercially focused teams to advise on the current and future legislation that you need to know about. With 44 offices in 21 countries located in major global cities, we can make that happen. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard.
We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from the offices of Squire Patton Boggs, this is Capital Thinking. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment via Twitter by following our handle at Capital Thinking. Now, back to the program.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. We are joined by another one of my colleagues, Lacey Colo, who's a partner in Squire Patton Boggs' Washington, D.C. office and resident in the intellectual property and technology practice. Lacey represents domestic and international clients through every stage of IP development and management. That means things like patent prosecution, patent litigation, licensing, tech transfer. So we're going to continue the discussion we started with Greg Lauer in the last segment by talking now a little bit about the Strong Patents Act. That's a bill that's pending that advocates on behalf of innovators everywhere. So, Lacey, we were talking to Greg about patent reform. It seems like we have had a round of patent reform, and now we've got some things pending. We have this bill proposed by Senator Coons of Delaware, Senator Durbin of Illinois, Senator Hirono of Hawaii. Give us a little bit of background about the Strong Patents Act and what it all means.
Sure. You know, I think in some way that the Strong Patent Act is a reaction to something which was passed in 2012, and that was the Leahy-Smith American Events Act. It really greatly changed the patent laws in the United States. There was a perception that there were a lot of bad patents out there that were issued by the Patent Office in error, and that companies, as I say, patent trolls were out there enforcing these patents against companies in the United States. So the question is, what were your remedies if you got sued or if you got threatened to sued by a patent troll? And at the time, the Patent Office had a process called reexamination, where if a patent was issued, you can go back to the Patent Office and say, hey, guys, no offense, but we think there was a problem here. You didn't consider all of these references. You should take another look at this. But that process was very drawn out. It took years. Not a lot of got through. So what the American Events Act did, it came into effect September 16, 2012, and it added a lot of new, what they call post-grant proceedings. This is after a patent is issued. It has all these new proceedings where you can go before the patent office and say, hey, can you guys please examine these? We think, again, they're bad patents because of ABC. But what the American Events Act did is it said that these procedures were fast-tracked. They had to be concluded in 12 months or 18 months if you take all the extensions. And the idea with these new proceedings is that you were going to have a faster, cheaper, better way to challenge low-quality patents. But what happened is over the past 2.5 years is that the post-grant procedures did their job a little well. The kind of unintended consequences, not only did you have the Supreme Court cases that came out over the past 2 years, and many of those said it might be more difficult to obtain a patent. But then you had the new procedures, and these new procedures were very effective. In the beginning, as much as 95% of the adjudicated patent claims were being validated. And so some people started calling the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that oversaw these procedures, the PTAB, they started calling it the Patent Death Squad. But there are a lot of industries which depend heavily on patents, such as biotech and pharma. And I think, you know, based on everything I'm seeing and hearing, that the Strong Patents Act is a result of kind of the backlash of the American Events Act.
All right. So we know a little bit now about the Strong Patents Act. If it does pass, why don't you walk us through some of the major things it does to change in the law?
Sure. So as you can tell, the Strong Patent Act is very pro-innovator and pro-patent owner. A large portion of it is directed to the post-grant proceedings that came into place from the 2012 American Invents Act. For instance, it changes how patent claims are challenged and interpreted. The claims now are going to be presumed valid, which just means it's a higher standard and a little extra step to try and declare them to be invalid. And the claims have to be construed the same as they were in litigation in a district court. Because what happened was it was almost a lower threshold if you went before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to invalidate a patent versus if you went to district court. There are also a lot of other provisions in here. There's a lot in here. But basically, you know, there's a couple provisions that help small businesses. It eliminates what's called a fee diversion. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is actually very profitable because you have to pay for an application of a patent or a trademark. But basically what happens now is the PTO would get to keep their money. You don't have to ask to keep, you know, Congress if they can keep their money or not. And it would also give the Federal Trade Commission greater ability to go after people who send misleading cease and demand letters. In other words, if somebody sends a letter in bad faith, like what was common is people would think the patent troll would own a patent and they'd send out 20 letters to people saying, you infringe our patent, we may threaten to sue you if you don't do A, B, and C. Basically, the FTC now can go after people who are issuing these letters that may be fraudulent or misleading.
Interesting. Very interesting. The Supreme Court, I know, has had a lot to say. Greg and I talked about that in the last the segment. So does the Strong Patent Act address the Supreme Court decisions that have been issued, like Octane Fitness, over the last few years?
Absolutely. You know, the people who stand behind this bill, as you can probably tell based on reading the bill, weren't very happy with the Supreme Court. You know, what they did is they did a couple of different things. They addressed, like, the Supreme Court Limelight decision that this bill adds a law on what's called divided infringement. So it says it shall not be a requirement that the steps of a patented process be practiced by a single entity. And what that kind of means is the problem that we're having currently is that you have companies where they will, like, to infringe a patent, you have to meet every part of that patent claim. And so what would happen is if you had, like, four steps of a patent claim, you have people that do three steps, but then they instruct a customer to do the fourth step. And the question is, well, not one person meets every step. It's two people that do four steps. And it was called induced infringement, and you could actually, if you held a patent, you can go after them. Well, the Supreme Court basically said, no, one person has to perform all the steps. So what this does is this bill opens the door back up for induced infringement. It also harmonizes the standard for willfulness with the Supreme Court standard for frivolous litigation, which is the Octane Fitness decision you just talked about.
All right. That is very helpful to know. So I talked to Greg Lauer a little bit about, you know, some of the players that are involved. Talk to me again about some of the industries that might be in support of the Strong Patents Act.
Well, we know at least two which are very strongly in support. Before the bill actually was even introduced, Kunz had put up a website about the Strong Patents Act, and the Biotechnology Industry Organization and two associations, university associations, had already issued a statement of support. As you can imagine, the biotech pharma community very heavily depends on patents. They put a lot of money into research and into clinical trials with the hopes that in the end, when it's approved by the FDA, they can use the patents to keep their competitors off the market and gain some of that money back. So biotechnology is very interested. Biopharma is very interested. The Medical Device Manufacturers Association also issued a statement of support. This is actually one of the things I think that kind of surprised people was that the university associations came out under this in support of this bill, and it really shouldn't. You know, universities now are very sophisticated in the patent realm. They almost every single one has a technology transfer or an office of technology licensing, and what they do is they work with their researchers to make so that when the researchers come up with new ideas, they'll go ahead and patent it, they'll license it and see if they can possibly make a little money for the university. There was a study that came out by AUTUM, which is the American University Technology Managers Association, that said that in 2014, I believe, that over 25,000 patents were filed by universities. And some of the larger blockbusters, like Allegra, for instance, Allegra came out of Georgetown University. So a lot of drugs and a lot of products which are patented are coming out of academic research laboratories. So it's no surprise that the Association of American Universities and the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities are both issued statements of support of this bill.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, so we talked about who supports. What about who's in opposition?
In opposition, several industries have been very hard by the patent trolls. I would guess that the people who would be opposing this bill would be software industries. Generally, in the software industry, a lot of companies have moved towards open source or towards using organizations to do mass licensing, and they try their best to encourage open exchange of software, especially since, to write a patent application on software, anybody can do it. You don't necessarily need to be a company. And there's a lot of money in those technology companies, so they've been hit very hard by some people who have held rights to patents and have enforced them. So I would expect that a lot of the big tech industries would likely oppose this bill.
All right, very good. Lacey, give folks your contact information if they want to talk to you a little bit more about these issues.
Sure, absolutely. So my email address, I can be found at Lacey, L-A-C-Y, dot Kolo, K-O-L-O, at squirepb.com. My office number is 202-457-6051. If anybody's interested in discussing this, feel free to reach out. It's very interesting to see the different bills which are being proposed. A lot of people thought that the American Invents Act in 2012 was going to be the last big push for patent reform, but it may just be we're not there yet. So,
all right, very good. Well, we'll be back with more in just a minute here on Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. We are much more than just a public policy and lobbying firm. We are a leading international legal practice that excels in the areas where government, law, and business meet. We understand countries, cultures, and how business works across the globe. We use our expertise to deliver tailored solutions to the individual challenges our clients face, when and where they need them. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Live from the offices of Squire Patton Boggs, this is Capital Thinking. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment via Twitter by following our handle at Capital Thinking. Now, back to the program.
All right, we're going to turn our attention now to the world of financial regulation, talk about the complex area of derivatives regulation. I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Matt Culkin and Todd Gibson. They co-chair the Squire Patton Boggs Task Force on Derivatives Regulation. Matt works with me here in D.C. He comes at things from the public policy angle. He was recently appointed the co-chair of the D.C. Bar Association's Derivatives and Futures Committee on the Corporation Finance and Securities Law Section. Todd, however, is based in Cleveland, where Hope Springs Eternal for the Browns. He spent a significant part of his career working on Wall Street. He looks at things from a commercial perspective. So happy to have both folks on. And maybe the place to start, Matt and Todd, is to explain that people, when they hear derivatives, they think about the things that caused the financial crisis of 2008. And they know that Dodd-Frank made for some big changes. So why don't you give an update? We'll start with you, Matt, on how the regulatory framework has changed in the last few years as Dodd-Frank has been implemented.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having us on. The world has changed a lot. Back in 2008, there really wasn't a whole lot of U.S. federal regulation for derivatives markets. So out of the 2008 crisis was born the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. That law is 2,000 pages with 16 different titles. But for derivatives purposes, it's really Title 7 is the big one, which is about 200 pages, and it covers the new regulatory framework for both swaps, which are now overseen by something called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, but also something called a security-based swap, which is overseen by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. There are really three fundamental pillars that were put in place, the first being that swaps now have to be traded on regulated trading platforms called swap execution facilities. And after they're traded there with all sorts of pre-trade price transparency benefits, they're then cleared and sent to something called a central clearinghouse. And that clearinghouse essentially stands as the guarantor to both sides and effectively as the counterparty to the trade. And what that does is it means if there were to be a failure of a large financial institution again, that clearinghouse would be able to step in and prevent a run or a financial crisis. And then last but not least, the trades are then reported to something called a trade repository, which is basically a really big warehouse that keeps all of the trade data in one place, and it allows the regulators to have a clear view of exactly what's going on in the market. The CFTC covers about 90% of the market share, and so they took the lead on writing their rules. They've made the big banks register as something called swap dealers. They've finalized almost all of their rules on these areas that come out of Dodd-Frank and Congress. And as a result, as you can imagine, the regulatory compliance has really taken a sharp tick up. Folks are really trying to make sure they comply with every rule. The dust is starting to settle on the rules and compliance and making sure that everyone is dotting their I's and crossing their T's. But the big piece is making sure that the rules don't make the swaps markets too expensive. And that would result in really pricing out end users, which politically is not popular, but commercially is also not good for the markets.
Okay. Todd, now that we know Dodd-Frank is getting further into the implementation stage, let's talk. You were an end user. Talk to us about how end users are adapting to this new landscape.
Well, thanks, Kevin. They're sort of taking it one step at a time here, taking their lead from the big dealers, the international dealers, the Wall Street banks, the European dealers, Japanese dealers. The regulatory brunt of Dodd-Frank hit the dealers. It's their activity that's being regulated, but there are implications for end users that the end users are, just day by day figuring out what it is they need to do. And part of that is the dealer community coming to terms with what the regulation implies. There are plenty of places in the rules and the regulations where there's a lot of gray area. It's not clear exactly what one rule is supposed to mean exactly. And as the dealers figure it out, the end users then get that direction in terms of things that they need to do to make sure their swap trading is in compliance with the rules. And part of that is dealers communicating consistently in the market. So end users aren't hearing one message from one dealer and a different message from another. It's been 2 years of some confusion, but that's beginning to, as Matt said, the dust is beginning to settle, and there's clarity and market conventions beginning to form. But, you know, going forward, there are still a lot of unanswered questions. As some of these things get sorted out, there are requirements for end users that are, frankly, too burdensome, probably for the benefit that the market derives. Matt mentioned the transparency and the reporting of transactions. End users, each swap will be reported up, and to the extent there are co-counterparties or co-borrowers on an instrument, each of them need to report, and that requires them to jump through hoops in terms of getting identification numbers and different things that simply weren't part of the market before and now are. But, you know, there are some growing pains, but hopefully as additional rules are adopted or revised or clarified, you know, there'll be additional relief and we'll work through some of these pressure points.
Okay, Matt, so let me throw that back to you. How do you see, besides these end users, how's the marketplace adjusting overall?
I'd say they're adjusting very slowly. As part of Dodd-Frank, a lot of these market participants had to register with the government, either as a swap dealer, which is a participant that deals in these instruments, or there are these new trading platforms that are called swap execution facilities. These repositories that are storing the data are called swap data repositories. They have to register. And so that meant they had to file application forms, supplement those filings as time went on. They had regulators coming in and visiting and touring their facilities, a series of, you know, conference calls and meetings and investigatory matters. And so the registration process is slowly moving forward, but probably closer to the end than the beginning. So that's making progress. At the same time, the CFTC really flew through the rulemaking. They adopted all of their rules faster than any other financial regulator coming out of Dodd-Frank. And so as a result, there's a natural tendency to go back and revisit some of those rules. Over the last couple of years, we've seen hundreds of what are called no action letters get issued. And those no action letters are a way to help market participants comply with the rule, maybe not every single subsection, every dot of it, but the no action letter is issued to give market participants relief from some of the more complicated or logistically challenging pieces. And while that no action is in place, particularly at the CFTC, the agency now has the chance to go back and relook at the rule they adopted and figure out if there's any need or desire to amend those rules. And that, of course, under the Administrative Procedure Act is time consuming and requires a lot of labor because you have to put the documents out for public notice and comment and then consider all of the comment letters that come in before issuing a new final rule. But that's balanced by the need for real regulatory certainty so that these companies can complete the transition to the new regulated landscape. And there's a lot to be said for having regulatory certainty when you're operating a business. So while the CFTC is working out the kinks in their rules, the SEC, by contrast, is a little bit more deliberative and hasn't finished as many of their rules. And so we expect in 2015 to see the pace pick up at the SEC while they finish their rules. And the challenge there will be to make their rule set as harmonized as possible with the existing rules adopted by the CFTC, but not a total blanket adoption because a mirror rule of a bad rule doesn't really help anyone. So we're watching that with great interest.
All right, very good. So, Todd, I know you focus a lot of your legal practice on government entities, municipal, local government. There's some stuff in Dodd-Frank for them. Are those protections having the intended effect?
Yes, Kevin. I think they are. You know, one of the big elements of Title VII of Dodd-Frank was that the legislators saw or perceived certain abuses in the market. And I think, you know, you can point to cases, Jefferson County, Alabama, different places where swap instruments were probably used in an abusive fashion. And so there are various protections built in. And primarily it has a number of, imposes a number of requirements on dealers. There are external business conduct rules where they need to do a bit more diligence, provide more transparency and disclosure to these certain types of entities, governmental entities, authorities, things like that. And those rules are in place, and you can see that they are making a difference in the way that dealers approach governmental entities. It has cooled the market in that space, which is probably not a bad thing. Everyone's being much more deliberate and candid as they're moving forward. I don't know that there's a whole lot of public officials that are keen on derivative instruments at this point, but much of what governmental entities do with derivatives is hedge interest rate exposure. And as we see the Fed moving toward potentially raising rates, I think there will be increased interest in interest rate hedges and caps. I think we'll see more activity in that space. But in the meantime, you know, these new disclosures are in place. The requirement that these entities hire independent advisors that can help coach them on the math and other implications of these instruments, I think it'll all be beneficial. I think the market ultimately will come back to a point of normal activity, but hopefully on a much much more equal footing and information being shared on a much more symmetrical basis.
All right, Matt, last question. I know you're here with me in D.C. What is Congress and these various alphabet soups agencies that oversee derivatives and Dodd-Frank, where do they stand?
Well, we're watching very carefully as the agencies, the CFTC, they had a change in leadership at the end of last summer. And so as a result, there's sort of some new thinking and some fresh faces, and they're trying to figure out where the rules need to be amended to make a little bit more sense from a public policy standpoint. At the same time, we're watching very carefully with the Republican-controlled House and Senate. They're using their legislative oversight authority to the extent possible. They're holding a lot of hearings on Dodd-Frank, a lot of hearings on derivatives regulation, where they're bringing in both the regulators but also market participants to figure out what needs to be amended and what message Congress can send to the administration about the direction of oversight. And at the same time, the CFTC's governing statute, it's called the Commodity Exchange Act, it's up for reauthorization right now, which means that Congress is sending the CFTC all sorts of different messages and direction as they try to figure out how to amend that law and repass it for the next few years.
Very good. All right, that's going to do us for this segment. We're going to be back in just a minute to continue our talks about financial services regulation and policy here on Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business, check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. We are much more than just a public policy and lobbying firm. We are a leading international legal practice that excels in the areas where government, law, and business meet. We understand countries, cultures, and how business works across the globe. We use our expertise to deliver tailored solutions to the individual challenges our clients face, when and where they need them. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from the offices of Squire Patton Boggs, this is Capital Thinking. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment via Twitter by following our handle at Capital Thinking. Now, back to the program.
All right, welcome back. We are joined by three of my colleagues to talk about tax reform and domestic and international impacts of the treatment of municipal bonds in tax reform. Joining us, Brandon Roman, Micah Green, and Bern Gilby, all of whom focus their practice on various aspects of tax. Two of them, Bern and Micah, are heads of our tax-related practices here at Squire Patton Boggs. Micah Green chairs the firm's financial services and tax policy practice based out of Washington, D.C., and Bern Gilby, who's calling in from across the pond in London, is the chair of the firm's tax benefit and strategy practice. And then Brandon Roman is an associate in the tax policy practice, also based here in D.C. So, Brandon, we will start with you. With all the discussion going on about tax reform and whether or not we can get it done in this 114th Congress, why don't you bring us up to speed on what the current political landscape is?
Thanks, Kevin. So as you mentioned, lawmakers are right now debating comprehensive tax reform, which in other words means reforming both business and individual portions of the tax code. To put the current debate in perspective, like you said, I think we need to review how the debate's evolved over the past several years. Before the last Congress adjourned, former Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp formally introduced his comprehensive tax reform legislation, but the plan was met with bipartisan opposition, including opposition from more than 50 House Republicans who expressed concern about the proposed tax on banks and its potential to impact lending and economic activity. So while it wasn't actually ever enacted, many have characterized his proposal as a starting point for the debate this Congress. Since calling to order the 114th Congress, both Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committees have been very busy working towards their own comprehensive tax reform proposals, although each has taken a different approach. In the House, Chairman Paul Ryan has led the committee through a series of markups to make permanent so-called tax extenders. But a key point of contention has remained, and that is the Republicans' unwillingness to provide offsets to the cost of these tax extenders. Chairman Ryan insists, though, that this is necessary to ensure, quote, an honest baseline for the committee's efforts on tax reform. So taking a different approach, the Senate Finance Committee has not yet addressed tax extenders and will actually likely wait until later this year to do so. Instead, the committee is focused on holding a series of hearings thus far to gather information and develop its own approach to tax reform. Also, as part of the committee's efforts, I'll note that Chairman Hatch and Ranking Member Wyden have formed five bipartisan working groups to, quote, spur congressional comprehensive tax reform efforts. Each of these working groups has been tasked with submitting a proposal on targeted issues to the committee by May of this year. I'll note for our listeners that these working groups are now actually seeking public input, which really does provide a unique opportunity to impact the debate going forward. So if those are interested, our tax public policy group is ready and happy to assist with any of the drafting or questions you might have. In addition to congressional efforts, earlier this year, President Obama also put forth his own tax proposals included in his 2016 fiscal year budget request. Included in that proposal were proposals relating to increasing top capital gains rate to 28%, curtailing the stepped-up basis on inherited assets, and imposing a 7-basis-point fee on the liabilities of about 100 of the largest financial institutions. It also contained a proposal for a 19% minimum tax on foreign earnings of multinational corporations and a one-time 14% tax on their previously untaxed foreign income. So, given the stark contrast that we see between the proposals currently circulating in Washington, the one thing that does appear quite clear is that comprehensive tax reform, while possible, will be exceedingly difficult to achieve during the 114th Congress. However, as we may have time to discuss later in the program, and has been suggested by various committee members, such as Sherrod Brown of Ohio, even if lawmakers aren't able to come to an agreement on comprehensive tax reform, they might be able to come to an agreement on targeted reforms of the U.S. tax code. So we really do encourage stakeholders to remain engaged in the debate, as those proposals that are considered now will, at a very minimum, serve as a benchmark going forward for the debate on tax reform.
So, Michael, let me shift gears to you. That was a lot to absorb there. One of the things I know you spend a lot of time on in the tax policy group looking at is the tax treatment of municipal bonds. You yourself are the former president and CEO of the Bond Market Association, so you are a great expert here. Talk to me a little bit about the potential impact tax reform has on the municipal bond market. What's at stake in this fight?
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, in general, if there is comprehensive tax reform debated either this year, next year, or maybe when a new president comes in 2017, it'll look at comprehensive tax reform across the board, corporate, international, individual. And anytime you look at comprehensive tax reform, you look at where are all the tax benefits going and whether or not you can eliminate or modify those to generate enough revenue to lower tax rates. And the tax exemption of bonds, of interest on bonds issued by states and localities, is one of the larger tax expenditure items. And so, therefore, it's a big target. So if you're going to reduce tax expenditures, states and localities need to gather their resources to argue why it is it's important to maintain the tax exemption and lower the rate of interest that they have to pay as issuers of tax-exempt municipal bonds. And remember, tax-exempt municipal bonds are exempt from federal, and they tend to be exempt from state and local taxation in the state they're issued. And what that does in the marketplace is reduce the cost of borrowing for building roads and bridges and schools and other public infrastructure projects. So on the overall tax reform area, municipal bonds are very much an issue that should be discussed. And as Brandon mentioned, the roundtables that are being held at the Senate Finance Committee, there's one on infrastructure and community development. States and localities and anyone involved in the municipal bond market should be voicing their opinion on this issue right now so that their opinion is clear. But here and now, there's also a chance of a tax bill this year where municipal bond issues could come up, because in May, the highway trust fund expires and needs to be reauthorized for a period of time. And anytime you do that, it becomes an opportunity to discuss infrastructure finance, infrastructure development. In fact, the administration just released in their budget a series of infrastructure proposals, and some of those infrastructure proposals actually enhance the municipal bond program. So, for example, they create a whole new class of broader-based bonds called Qualified Infrastructure Private Activity Bonds. Of course, it's got an acronym, QPIBS. So the point being that even though tax reform is somewhere on the horizon later this year, next year, or even beyond when a new president comes in, here and now in 2015, there may be legislative activity where municipal bonds have to come up. Now, the one opportunity is that broadening the municipal bond program to meet more of the nation's infrastructure needs. The one risk element is that under the Congress's rules, any proposal that costs revenue has to be paid for. So anything that costs revenue, like the expansion of the private activity bonds, could actually need to be paid for out of the municipal bond area. So again, issuers and other participants in the municipal bond program need to be alert to this, and we as a firm are very much involved in it, both because of my background and because of the breadth of the public finance practice within Squire Patton Boggs.
All right, Byrne, let's come and turn to you a little bit. The impact of comprehensive tax reform is not a United States event. Even as it passes our Congress, it really transcends all borders. Tell us a little bit about what tax reform in the United States could have on non-United States-based corporations.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. Thank you very much for inviting me on today's program. As I'm sure your listeners will appreciate, there won't be too many multinational businesses, certainly of any meaningful size, that won't be carrying on business in the U.S. And if you're carrying on business in the U.S., you're going to have a keen interest in any changes to the U.S. tax system. So if you start with something as simple as the headline rate of corporate income tax in the U.S., the currently relatively high rate is a real cost of doing business in the U.S., certainly if you compare it to the rest of the G20. If one of the features of U.S. tax reform is a proposal to reduce that headline rate, in reality, the cost of doing business in the U.S. starts to fall, and it does become a more attractive country in which to invest and expand. That is, of course, if the reduction in the headline rate isn't funded out of, as Micah just said, reduced tax deductions or the withdrawal of subsidies. In fact, I was with Don Moorhead, one of our U.S. tax partners from the Washington, D.C. office, a few days ago, and we spent some time with the tax directors of two UK-listed companies, both of which generate roughly 40% of their revenues in the U.S. Both of these individuals were very interested to hear about the likelihood of tax reform hitting the statute books, and if so, in what sort of time frame. Interestingly, in both cases, one of the most important features of the changing tax landscape in the U.S. is the potential for greater restrictions to be adopted, say, on the tax relief available on interest paid on loans that have been set up to finance the commercial operations, the so-called earnings strippings rules. Now, it seems possible, as I understand it, that either as part of U.S. tax reform or possibly even just as an interim response to the spate of recent U.S. inversions, that the earnings stripping rules might be tightened up. As I mentioned, both of these tax directors were very interested in the prospects of changes to these rules. As one of them explained, these kinds of changes do affect commercial decisions. The current rules on earnings strippings mean that by debt funding the U.S. commercial activities by way of loans from outside the U.S., the effective rate of tax paid on the profits generated in the U.S. start to get closer to the sorts of headline tax rates you see elsewhere in the world.
Martin, I'm going to have to. I got to jump in on you there. We got to wrap our show up, and maybe we can continue this discussion next week. But we're out of time here on Capital Thinking. Hope everyone has a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with Squire Patton Boggs. We hope to have you join us again for more insight next week. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Channel.